Herb Mondros on behalf of petitioner Ralph Swan with me on my appellant Elizabeth Vaheen and Michael Wiseman. With the court's permission, Mr. Wiseman will make the argument this morning.
Fine.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I appreciate, once again, your giving me the opportunity to address the court. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start out by noting the trial court's sentencing opinion in this case, which is found at page 2707 of the appendix. Quote, evidence of the specific circumstances of Swan's childhood is scant because his mother disappeared with him when he was 11. The next information about Swan relates to his arrest in Texas at age 20. Because of this limited information, the court cannot conclude that Swan's upbringing was so bad as to constitute a mitigating circumstance, close quote. The reason that there was that gap in the evidence is because trial counsel failed to do a reasonable and constitutionally acceptable investigation of Swan's childhood. They failed to conduct any investigation whatsoever into his mother's mistreatment of him and the abuse he suffered at the hands of his mother's boyfriends and her subsequent husband, Charles Griffin Sr. Counsel's failure to investigate was constitutionally unreasonable in this instance because they were actually aware that Mr. Swan had been abused. That's evidenced by the fact that in their opening statement, they promised the jury that they would hear evidence that Mr. Swan was raised in an abusive home situation. And that's at page 2314. And in fact, at page 2317, they specifically tell the jury that the jury should find as a mitigating factor that Mr. Swan was raised in an abusive environment.
Mr. Wiseman, let me just see if I can understand where your position, were we to accept it, how that would play out in a penalty hearing. As I understand it, at the time of the sentence, the trial judge had the last word, and the jury's recommendation was a recommendation that had to be given great weight, but it wasn't dispositive. If the evidence that you suggest had been developed by further investigation and had been properly presented, it's possible. I mean, the argument would be, I gather, it's possible, although we can never know, that might have influenced one juror, in which case you'd have a 6-6 recommendation, or possibly a second juror, we don't know. But does that, where do you go with that?
Yeah, fortunately for our position, I would submit, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in the Outen case addressed an identical set of circumstances. There was a jury vote of 7-5 for death. And the Court of Appeals found prejudice in a Delaware case based on the same argument we presented to this court, which is that if even one juror had changed their vote, it could have influenced the trial court's ultimate decision.
The trial court or some hypothetical, more objective trial court?
That was my next point. I think where Judge Babiar's erred in concerning prejudice is that he looked at it subjectively. It would not have changed my mind. And Strickland is very clear, Strickland v. Washington, that it is an objective test. And it's, again, particularly helpful for our position that Strickland was a Florida case with judge sentencing, just like Delaware, obviously with some differences. And Strickland very clearly said that the trial court's expression in that post-conviction case that the new evidence would not have changed
okay.
So I just
want to make sure I'm following you. Your position, assuming we were to accept it, would require, in order to result in a reversal, number one, that we would have to hypothesize that one or more jurors would be swayed to vote the other way.
Well,
correct?
I'm not sure you'd have to make that conclusion. We submit that is likely what will happen. The standard
well,
is
Matt, what's the right word? Speculate, hypothesize,
I mean,
assume. I mean, what?
I guess the specific legal finding you would have to make is that there is a reasonable probability that a juror would have changed their vote. So it's not speculating that the legal formulation is a reasonable probability.
So we have to assume that that more likely than not.
It's reasonable probability standard is less than a preponderance. We articulated that in our briefs.
Reasonable probability is less than a preponderance.
I'm sorry?
All right. Well, then somewhere south of more probable than not, one or more jurors would be swayed to vote the other way.
That's right.
And number two, if that happened, then a neutral, fully objective trial judge would have also been persuaded.
And that would be by the same standard of reasonable probability, less than a preponderance.
Right. Okay, but I mean, those two propositions are essential to your position, putting to one side the merits of whether or not there was a proper
that
investigation.
That is strictly the prejudice standard. And I'm sorry, I don't think I was disagreeing with Your Honor. I was startled by the use of the word speculate or hypothesize, because I don't think that's what any court would be doing here. You're simply looking at the evidence and making a judgment call that
Well, maybe a better way to express it is we have to posit a scenario.
Now, that scenario involves an assessment of more than just the additional mitigation evidence that you have uncovered or present counsel has uncovered. It involves an assessment of everything that would be introduced, including the rebuttal evidence that the state presented at the Rule 61 hearing. Is that correct?
I don't recall that the state, the state did present a mental health professional.
Right.
The answer is yes. You would need to consider the trial mitigation, the Rule 61 mitigation, and any aggravation or rebuttal that the state presented either at trial or in the Rule 61 proceeding.
So we look at the whole picture.
Correct.
Of everything, if everything that you're saying is missing and everything that the state said in response is their rebuttal, if all of that had been presented, would the outcome have been different? Is there a reasonable probability?
Reasonable probability, that's correct.
Okay. And recently the U.S. Supreme Court addressed, and I see that Judge Babiar cited it, Harrington versus Richter.
That's right.
In his opinion. And in Cullen
versus Penholster?
Yes. In Cullen versus Penholster, the opinion states a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. That requires a substantial, not just a conceivable, likelihood of a different result. Is that the test that we apply?
Well, to my knowledge, my understanding of Penholster and Richter, those are both cases looking at an ineffectiveness claim through the prism of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. That is the federal habeas statute, the amendments to that statute, that give great deference to what state courts do with such claims. So I would submit this court shouldn't take too much from those two decisions, because they are primarily about AEDPA deference to state court rulings. You obviously don't have that layer of review to go through, because you, after all, are making the decision in the first instance. So my understanding is that the standard, the Strickland prejudice standard, has not been overruled. It is still a reasonable probability of a different outcome, which has been defined variously in this circuit, or I should say in the Third Circuit, as well as by the Supreme Court and in Strickland itself, as less than a preponderance of the evidence. That is still the standard.
Now Judge Babiar's, he did say, obviously, as you've indicated, that he would not have changed his sentence. But he also said that the outcome of the proceeding would not have been different if this evidence had been presented. Wasn't that his final statement?
Yes, and Judge Babiar has also made a number of errors in his prejudice analysis, which I think also impact any view this court might have that he conducted an objective prejudice analysis. I mean, our view is that he conducted a subjective prejudice analysis, and even if you want to assume it's an objective analysis, he got many things wrong. For example, he made a finding that Mr. Swan said or denied having ever been abused, and that's simply not in the record. trial counsel never testified to that. There's no evidence of that. What trial counsel, Mr. Jones, Commissioner Jones, said was that Mr. Swan was reluctant to discuss his childhood. Our expert, one of our experts, Dr. Dudley, testified at page 3372 of the appendix that that type of denial that type of reluctance to discuss a traumatic childhood is a hallmark, is symptomatic of a traumatic childhood. So I think that that's a significant error on the part of Judge Babiarz. He also, I would submit, erred in his prejudice analysis when he said this isn't the type of case where counsel failed to present any evidence in mitigation, and therefore I won't find prejudice. The recent case, 2010, United States Supreme Court, Sears v. Upton, it's one of the seven cases this court asked Judge Babiarz to address on remand, squarely rejects that argument. That's at 130 Supreme Court 3264-65. This is the trial court finding in Sears. This case cannot be fairly compared with those with little or no mitigation evidence is presented and where a reasonable prediction of outcome can be made. And the Supreme Court said, quote, the court failed to apply the proper prejudice inquiry. We have never limited the prejudice inquiry under Strickland to cases in which there is only, quote, little or no mitigation evidence presented. So Judge Babiarz is one of his pillars of his no prejudice finding has squarely been rejected by the United States Supreme Court in Sears and before that. Sears is a particularly apt discussion of it. Let me just say, I can see the court appears to be most concerned about the prejudice prong here. The seven cases that Your Honors asked Judge Babiarz to address on remand, all of them have components of the type of evidence that we presented in the Rule 61 proceeding. So Williams, prejudice is found where there's childhood abuse, family dysfunction, cognitive difficulties. We've got all that. Wiggins, there's physical and sexual abuse, family dysfunction, emotional disturbance. Rompilla, physical abuse, organic brain damage, family dysfunction. Porter, abuse of childhood, impaired mental health. Germain, childhood abuse, mental illness. Houghton, physical, sexual, emotional abuse, and family dysfunction. These types of proofs are really the hallmark of a properly conducted trial penalty phase, and they are certainly at the core of what the United States Supreme Court and the Third Circuit has found important in assessing trial counsel ineffectiveness. If you don't present abuse, if it's assuming it's present, abuse, dysfunction, impoverishment, traumas, and mental illness and organic brain damage, if it's available and it's reasonably available, as it was here, and counsel fails to present it, that is prejudice.
You are accurate as to those items being found in those cases, but more was lacking as well. Isn't that so?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not recollecting where there might have been more. Certainly each case has different facets to it. I mean, one or more of them might have had some additional mitigating factor, but they all have what we have. They all have those as elements, the abuse, the neglect, the organic brain damage, the trauma, the PTSD. Those are all components of these cases. I also want to point out that when Justice Ridgely, you talked about considering the state's rebuttal at the Rule 61, their rebuttal was pretty thin on the mitigation piece of this. They presented a psychologist who, examined Mr. Swan and found himself that Mr. Swan had been terribly abused. His whole position was, well, he was abused, but I don't know that it affected him in a way that the defense psychologist and psychiatrist believe it affected him. And I would respectfully submit that's a jury question. If trial counsel failed to present that evidence, that a jury would have then weighed against Dr. Samuels, the state's rebuttal expert, that's what juries do in these cases. And when it isn't presented, I don't think this court can say because the state put on a rebuttal expert, because the experts canceled each other out, there's no prejudice. In these cases, when you have competing experts, the jury makes a decision on that, or the fact finder being the judge. And that's, you know, that's the proper way for these cases to go forward. Obviously, we didn't have that opportunity because of the ineffectiveness of counsel.
Mr. Wiseman,
yes.
I understand that if we were to find that there was Strickland prejudice, that a new penalty hearing would be required. Is it also your position that a new merits hearing would be required?
A guilt phase hearing?
I'm sorry, that there would have to be a new trial on guilt?
Well, we have a claim before your honors, which the DNA claim, which we addressed the last time I was here, and we certainly hope we'll get a new trial on that. But should you only agree to grant relief on the claim that we're discussing today, the result would be just a new penalty.
The reason I asked is that I think it was the concluding sentence in your briefs suggests you know, a new hearing on both elements.
You know what, if we said that was an error. This would only result in a new penalty hearing.
Mr. Wiseman, I'm sorry to focus on this perhaps too much, but no. I want to be sure that we apply the right analysis.
Sure.
I mean, you said it's a jury question, and therefore the jury should decide it. This is what, in Williams v. Beard, is a Third Circuit case decided in March of this year. And here's what they said, and I just want to ask you if you agree with it.
I can tell you I don't, because it was my case and I was on the short end, but I can tell you why I didn't agree with it.
It said, a careful prejudice inquiry requires that we consider all the relevant evidence that the jury would have had before it if counsel had pursued a different path, and it cites Wong. This includes evidence that was adduced at trial as well as that which was not presented until post-conviction review, citing Porter. Stated differently, we must reconstruct the record and assess it anew. In so doing, we cannot merely consider the mitigation evidence that went unmentioned in the first instance. We must also take account of the anti-mitigation evidence that the Commonwealth would have presented to rebut the petitioner's mitigation testimony, citing Wong. Once we have reconstructed the record, we must, quote, reweigh the evidence in aggravation against the totality of available mitigation evidence, unquote, citing Wiggins, and only then may we ask whether there is a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's ineffectiveness, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Is that accurate or inaccurate as a matter of law?
The reconstructing the record in federal habeas in order to determine whether the state courts resolution of the issue was proper under Supreme Court precedent requires consideration of all those things. My comment about it being a jury issue is really, so yes, that is a correct formulation. My point about it being a jury issue is that if a litigant were to present to a post-conviction court really outlandish, not credible evidence, I'm not saying that, you know, therefore you would have to find prejudice because some evidence was presented. Certainly there's a role for the post-conviction judge to say, well, this stuff just isn't credible. So you don't need prejudice because you haven't presented me credible evidence. But if we presented credible evidence and there is no findings here questioning the credibility of any of our evidence, since we presented credible evidence, my only point is the state can't knock that out simply by putting up their own expert and say, well, we rebutted that, so therefore there's no prejudice. If there's credible mitigating evidence that was not presented at trial and the state presents some rebuttal to that in post-conviction, then that all really should have been before a jury. I'm not saying that the Rule 61 is before a jury. What I'm saying is you put yourself back into the shoes of the trial setting and the question of whether our expert is better or their expert, whether our mitigation is more powerful than their aggravation, is a jury question. And that's my point about it.
I'd like to get back to something you said earlier about how Judge Babiar has used the wrong standard by saying that he wouldn't have changed his mind if he was aware of all this additional mitigating evidence. And you said the standard, in fact, is whether there's a reasonable probability that the jury would have you know, at least one juror would have changed his vote, and a reasonable probability that the judge would have changed his mind, correct?
A judge, not this judge.
Okay, well.
An objective finder.
Well, then maybe that's what I want to try and get to, because this judge has made it clear that the additional mitigating evidence is not enough to change his mind.
Right.
And why doesn't that end the inquiry? Because even if we assume that one or two jurors would have changed their votes, it still goes to the judge, and even giving great weight to whatever the final vote is, the judge heard everything, and this is his view of what the result should be. Are you saying that he's not allowed to hear this anymore, or
no,
what?
What I'm saying is that his formulation, that it wouldn't have changed my mind, is legally irrelevant. And Strickland says so. Strickland addressed the exact same set of circumstances. A trial judge in a judge sentencing state, which Florida is, just like Delaware, said exactly the same thing materially to what Judge Babiarz found in his opinion. And the Supreme Court said it matters not what a specific individual judge thinks about it, whether it would have changed his or her mind. The question is whether it would have changed the mind of an objective judge sitting in that position. So it is not a subjective test. Strickland says it. I don't have the cite in front of me. I could certainly submit it to the court if you'd like, but it's very plain in Strickland that they reject that formulation.
Well, that just raises a follow-up question to Justice Berger's, and that is, how do we put ourselves in, well, let me ask it differently. That analysis suggests two possibilities. One is that we completely disregard the views of the trial judge and start again with a hypothetical trial judge with a different cast of mind, or we don't do that, but reconstruct the evidence to determine whether an objective judge, or this judge with an objective cast of mind, could still conclude that despite the new mitigation evidence, that evidence is outweighed by the aggravating circumstances.
Even if Judge Babiarz hadn't made the subjective, objective mistake that I'm arguing on, even if that hadn't been made, he made other errors that are pointed out.
Yeah, but let's follow.
Right. So leaving that aside, the answer is yes, you would have to sit and say, would an objective judge sitting in this position, is there a reasonable likelihood, less than a preponderance, that would have changed that judge's mind, keeping in mind that under the statute that this case was tried under, great deference had to be afforded to the jury's vote. So we either would have had a 6-6 or a 7-5. We may have had 12-0 for life at that point, because we think this is pretty compelling evidence. But even assuming it was just one vote that switched, under the statute in effect then, the judge would have to have given it great weight, the objective judge sitting in Judge Babiarz's position. And that's the decision that this court now has to make.
Did you want to save your remaining minute?
Yes, I did want to save my minute and 28. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. On remand, the trial judge, who was also the judge at the post-conviction relief evidentiary hearing, was asked to respond to two particular questions. One was to address seven prior court decisions, five from the United States Supreme Court and two from the Third Circuit, United States Court of Appeals. And then secondly, to address whether the defendant, Ralph Swan, has shown prejudice under the two-pronged Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel test. The trial judge in the Rule 61 judge did that. He has issued an opinion on remand, and the state's position is that the trial judge did what this court asked. He methodically went through each of the seven decisions that the court asked him to consider. He addresses those, and he indicates that he, at one point, he says, these decisions are all distinguishable because they are based on counsel having failed to conduct any investigation relative to penalty or having failed to use available evidence. And
all of that, of course, Mr. Williams, all of that, of course, goes to whether or not there was a, that counsel acted reasonably in investigating possible mitigating circumstances. If you would just put that to one side for the moment, and focus on the prejudice element of Strickland. Mr. Wiseman has basically marched us through what he contends is the analysis that we would have to utilize in order to assess whether or not the mitigation evidence, had it been developed and then submitted to the jury, would have, by a reasonable probability, changed the outcome. Do you disagree with his view of the law in that respect? That is, as an abstract matter.
No, I think that's a correct statement. What the trial judge said in the remand opinion when he focused on the prejudice prong analysis, he said that the trial court, quote, cannot find that there is a substantial likelihood that the vote, the 7-5 jury vote, would have favored life imprisonment if the jury had been presented with the post-conviction evidence. So I think this substantial likelihood is similar standard. I don't think there's any real
difference. You don't see any difference between substantial likelihood and reasonable probability?
No, not really. I mean, I think you're all talking about the same thing.
All right. Well, suppose we were to conclude that possibly one juror might switch, which would lead to a 6-6 vote. What result?
Well, then we get into the fact that Delaware has a hybrid death penalty statute after the 1991 amendment, and it's a two-step process. And this court has indicated several times that the role of the jury is a recommendation. It's an advisory role as to what the ultimate sentencing will be. The jury makes a determination and casts a vote and actually announces what the vote is. In this case, it was 7-5. that the aggravators.
We're now, it's hypothetically at a 6-6 vote, and the judge now has to decide. What would be the mindset of that judge faced with a 6-6 vote under the Strickland standard? You know, what mental process is the judge supposed to go through? And
when it's that close? Well, the statute itself, when it was amended, it doesn't say that the trial judge is simply to count the votes. It's not like the Electoral College, whatever the popular vote was, the electors from Delaware have to cast their votes accordingly. But the statute doesn't place those kind of restrictions or requirements on the trial judge. The trial judge is required to give great deference to what the jury's recommendation is, but again, if it's a recommendation, it's not a binding recommendation, it's simply a recommendation, and then the trial judge independently has to make his own assessment, and that's the second part of the prejudice prong analysis the judge did.
Let me ask the question differently. We're reviewing the decision of this hypothetical newly enlightened trial judge. Do we give any deference to the judge's decision, or are we reviewing it de novo? That is, are we reviewing it as though we collectively were the sentencing judge?
No, I think you give deference to the decision, and then you simply analyze it the way you would any other judicial ruling. It's not a de novo review.
The point on analysis, I think, is critical here. And when Alton went to the Third Circuit basically held this court misapplied Strickland in another 7-5 case. What's the Third Circuit standard that we need to be considering in this case, which is also 7-5, so that we get it right?
Well, I think the standard is there a substantial likelihood that the jury vote, the 7-5 vote, would be different? And if there is not that showing, if the judge doesn't find that or the evidence doesn't support that, you don't get, you know, past that part of it. That's the jury recommendation stage, and then you move on to the trial judge's ultimate sentencing decision.
So we're going to apply the totality of the circumstances, as Justice Richley read from the most recent Third Circuit opinion.
Yes, I think that's it.
And you agree that where, if we go back to where Mr. Wiseman started, the trial judge admittedly said there was this 11-year gap in the history at the time of sentencing. And now the question for us, under a totality of the circumstances, if the 11-year gap had been filled in, would it have affected the jury's vote?
Yes, I think that's it. You look at all the evidence, and there was, this case was a little bit unusual in that the state actually presented some rebuttal expert psychological testimony to the, there wasn't expert psychological or psychiatric testimony at the original trial proceeding, but in the Rule 61, Mr. Swan presented both a psychiatrist, a Dr. Dudley, and I believe a psychologist, Dr. Armstrong.
But when we're doing this, is there any analogy to the harmless error standard where our court looks at an alleged error and we have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that it wouldn't have changed anybody's mind?
I don't know the answer to that. I haven't thought about that. I don't know if you can analogize to that or not. I think you have to do what the judge did here and decide, well, is there a substantial likelihood, first, that it would have changed the jury vote, and then secondly, would it have changed the trial judge, who was the sentencing judge and the Rule 61 judge, would it have changed his ultimate sentence? And he says no, that it wouldn't. I've heard all the evidence, including all the new evidence, pro and con, and I'm
well,
convinced that's the sentence. Go ahead.
Under Outen, if we were to conclude that there was a reasonable probability that this new evidence would have changed the vote of at least one juror, doesn't that predestine the outcome? In other words, you can read Outen as basically bypassing what the judge did or didn't do, that automatically there would have to be a new penalty hearing if the reviewing court concludes that even one juror would have changed that juror's mind.
No, I don't think so, because that's not what the Delaware state statute says. I mean, the statute says it's a recommendation. It's an advisory.
Well, are you aware of any 6-6 recommendations that have resulted in a death sentence?
No, I don't think so. Antonio Taylor, which was a Kent County case, was a 6-6, and I think he received a life sentence. Well, he did receive a life sentence. That's the only 6-6 I recall.
Justice Holland anticipated my question, and it's scary. I think he's reading my mind. What I'm thinking about is in between whether or not a single juror's vote may have been changed and whether or not an objective trial judge's consideration might have changed, does empirical data suggest anything to us that's relevant?
Well, I don't know if there's any empirical data.
And by that I mean, how many times has 7-5 recommendation for life resulted in a death sentence? Mm-hmm. How many times has 7-5 recommendation for death resulted in a life sentence? Does any history of the objective judge's decision-making suggest anything to us to bridge the gap of significance, if there is one, between a change in one juror's vote or more and the ability of an objective judge to analyze the situation apart from the recommendation?
Well, I think there certainly is a history. Every time we do a death penalty case, there's the appendix.
Is there,
everything.
Really what I'm asking is, assuming you know the history better than I, which is actually a substantially likelihood of that being the case, does it suggest anything about the way in which we look at the likelihood of an objective trial judge doing X, Y, or Z?
Well, I don't know. I've been surprised many times, and I just don't guess what juries are going to do. May as well have as much luck trying to guess where that little ball on the roulette wheel is going to be red or black. You just don't know. But I think there's been three Delaware death penalty cases where there was a 7-5, where there was a death sentence imposed. There was one in Newcastle. Unfortunately, I can't remember the name. There was Mr. Swan in Kent. And most recently, there was one in Sussex County where the vote was 7-5, where the police officer, Chad Spicer, was killed. And that jury recommendation was 7-5 for death, and the judge in Sussex did impose the death penalty. That, I believe, is probably on appeal now. It hasn't gone up on direct appeal. So I know there's, I think there's at least three. There's other cases. I know in Kent County there was a case we had where it was 8-4 for a death penalty, and I believe Judge Carpenter imposed a life sentence, and he said one of the important factors was the very young age of the defendant. So it kind of depends, I guess, on the judge and all the other factors in the particular case. But to get back to your original question, I don't know that there's been any death penalties for 6-6. The one case I do recall, Antonio Lee Taylor, was 6-6, and he received a life sentence.
There's not much to be gained by us engaging in some investigation to how the vote has gone under various circumstances in the past?
Well, I don't know that I'd say that is a blanket statement. I think it's certainly helpful, but again, it's kind of fact-driven by the cases, and you know, there's some people where it's been 8-4, and they've received a life sentence. Counting this one, there's three, I guess, or at least three, or it's 7-5, and the person has received a death sentence. So I think it's still going to break down to looking at all the facts. And
so what I'm struggling with is, as some of the other questions have suggested, that the Third Circuit may think it's significant that a jury recommendation vote might change. But the bottom line is it, under our statutory scheme, significant for any reason other than the fact that the Third Circuit thinks it might be?
Well,
we've gone from great weight to some weight to it's only a recommendation over the last 20 years. What is the significance of all that?
Well, I guess the significance is that you look at the vote, it's a recommendation. It's like any other recommendation you receive. You take it under advisement, you consider it, and then you weigh that with the totality of the other evidence, and the judge at the end has the very grave responsibility of making the final determination whether it's going to be a life sentence or a death sentence.
Well, you get the impression from the Third Circuit that they're certainly aware that in Delaware we've only had one case where the judge would override the jury's recommendation for life and impose death. That was Garden. And that was set aside anyway, and he ultimately wound up with life. But the Third Circuit seems to indicate that if a majority of the jurors vote to recommend death, the judge may or may not impose death, but more likely than not, the judge will impose death, although you've listed some exceptions. But when a majority of the jury recommends life, or when a majority of the jury is equally divided, that may be significant to the judge's thought process. Isn't that what we read from the Third Circuit cases?
Well, I think so. I think it is. It's certainly significant. Siddiqui Garden was kind of an aberration. I think it was 2-10, and the death penalty was initially imposed, or I think it was even imposed twice. But most of them, it's been 7-5 or above. In fact, all of them, I guess, it's 7-5 or above. But it's a matter of really what the statute says, and it's a state statute, and the statute lays out.
Well, Mr. Williams, we understand that, but we also have Outen to deal with, and I mean, that's the hard question is, if we hypothesize that the jury vote would have changed from 6-6, let's say, are we then by a reasonable application of Outen required to disregard the judge's, in effect, to disregard that sentence and order a new hearing? Or can we give, is there some analytical process by which we can review that sentence and possibly still uphold the death sentence, even with a hypothetical 6-6 vote?
Well, I think it's the latter.
I know you think it is, but how do you square it with Outen? Well, you know, what are we, you know, what process does this court go through in analyzing what the trial judge should or should not have done when faced with the 6-6 recommendation?
Well, I think the analytical process is the same with many judicial determinations. You decide whether it's a logical, rational determination.
That's deferential review. Okay. I'll ask him, but I anticipate that Mr. Wiseman would say, no, this is a de novo review.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's a deferential review. You have to give some credence to what the trial judge did, and then you have to analyze it, looking at all the evidence, and then say, okay, this is a rational determination and logical based on the evidence that the judge has reached this particular conclusion or bottom line or ultimate sentence.
Would you?
Didn't the test for our review of whether there's prejudice under Strickland, I'm thinking back to Smith versus State, which is the accomplice liability instruction and failure to give it, and the trial judge said, well, I gave a general credibility instruction, that's enough. But didn't this court say that we review prejudice, whether there's prejudice is a matter of law that we would review de novo? Did we say anything along those lines?
In Smith?
Yes.
I think it did. I don't recall Smith right off the top of my head. I know that it deals with the fact that the instruction and the general instruction was deemed insufficient in Smith.
Well, isn't the question for us, going back to Justice Jacobs' hypothetical where you have a 6-6 vote, if all of this mitigation evidence had come in that was missing, the 11-year gap, and under a totality of the circumstances, the juror's vote would have been 6-6, don't we also then have to go to the next step and say, if a judge who's the ultimate sentencer had heard all of that evidence and was faced with a 6-6 recommendation, would it have made a difference?
Well, I guess you can get to that point. It's so theoretical.
Our questions are designed to help have you help us distinguish Outen. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of where we want to go. The real question is, in these death penalty cases that take a great many years, we decided Outen to the best of our ability. It got reversed by the Third Circuit that said we were wrong with Strickland. So Outen had to be redone. We're trying to get this one right also, and we're trying to get you to help us understand what you think the law is after Outen.
Well, I think the law is, as I guess I've said a couple of times, what the statute says. And Outen doesn't categorically say if it's a 6-6 vote, you know, you're going to get life sentence. There's no way you can get a death sentence.
we understand that.
Yes.
My question is, going back to Justice Jacobs' hypothetical, if this mitigation evidence came in and it looks like the vote might have been 6-6 based on that, don't we then have to go to the next step and say, if the judge had also heard the mitigation evidence, taking the totality of the circumstances into effect, including that mitigation evidence and the 6-6 vote, would it have made a difference to a reasonable, objective judge imposing a sentence of either life or death?
Well, yeah, I think that's correct analysis. Here, though, you have the judge saying, well, I did hear all of this, and ultimately it doesn't make a difference in my sentence, and I don't find that there's a substantial likelihood that it would have affected the jury vote. And then it's a question, I guess, of just looking at the evidence. And here we have evidence really on both sides, at least in terms of the...
So your argument would be, to put it more finely, yes, I did hear this additional mitigation evidence, and yes, it does weigh more heavily than the original evidence in terms of mitigation, but even so, that mitigation evidence is still outweighed by the aggravating circumstances.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. I think that's exactly right. I'm sorry I didn't express it more clearly, but that's what the judge has concluded in this particular case, and I think that's right. He's gone through...
Again, can we, if that was the, what we should assume occurred here, that is, if that was the thought process of the trial judge, and we uphold that, and the case goes back to the Third Circuit, and the argument is under Outen, we reached the wrong conclusion, how would the Third Circuit come out?
That you reached the wrong conclusion? Well, I assume if they decide you reached the wrong conclusion, they're going to ultimately reverse it, yes. But I don't think...
Well, let me ask it differently. Would Outen say that we analyzed the case the wrong way and that we should have just basically automatically granted a new mitigation hearing?
Yeah. No, I don't think that's required. And the judge, he does go through what the evidence is, and in doing the prejudice prong, he talks about the childhood abuse evidence that they've now heard. He talks about the evidence of intellectual deficit, and he talks about the PTS. He specifically addresses each of those three factors, and I think that's what the trial judge was required to do here on the remand, and what he did was correct.
Okay, so you're saying that Outen, fairly read, doesn't require an automatic overturning of the death penalty. It does permit us to review the death sentence, notwithstanding a hypothetical 6-6 vote. And as long as we could conclude that the conclusion, that is the trial judge's conclusion, that the aggravators outweighed the mitigators, even as augmented by the new evidence, that should suffice.
I would think so, because otherwise you're going to just reduce this process down to counting the votes, and that's going to be the end of it. And I don't think it's ever been that simplistic. It certainly wasn't the intent of the amendment in 1991 to make it that simplistic. If there's any additional questions, I'll attempt to...
I have one. It was referred earlier that the trial court was wrong when it concluded that Swan told... defense counsel that he was not abused as a child.
I'm puzzled by that too. My understanding was that Swan, and I think this is testimony of Dave Jones at the Rule 61 hearing, Swan never said his mother beat him. That's at Appendix 3245, or that he was sexually abused. That's at page 3243. I think that's what Mr. Jones said he was told by Swan, was that he was not beaten by his mother and that he was not sexually abused. And that was the premise on which the defense counsel was operating at the time of the original hearing.
So the trial judge's decision on remand does not have a mistake as to what the record is?
Well, I think there was, there was that statement by Dave Jones. There's also a very odd thing that I put in my supplemental memo about Mr. Tucker. He testified to some hearsay that apparently wasn't objected to, that Mr. Swan had told him that he was locked in a closet from time to time by the mother and some of her friends while they partied. So there was some evidence of abuse that Mr. Tucker testified to at the original trial.
Thank you, Mr. questions? Williams.
Thank you.
Mr. Wiseman, let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel.
De novo review. Page 56 of our opening brief sets out the standard of review. Zabrowski, most recently in 2010, said this court reviews constitutional errors, claims of constitutional error, de novo.
All right. Well, let's apply that in a real world context. Let's assume that as a result of the new mitigation evidence, the jury now votes 6-6. The trial judge confronted with that and required to decide as between life and death, writes an opinion in which he says, I recognize the force of this, of the mitigation evidence. There certainly is substantial mitigation evidence, but being as objective and as fair as I can possibly be, I conclude that the aggravators still outweigh the mitigating evidence, and I sentence Mr. Swan to death. How do we review that? By what process?
You review it de novo.
Meaning what?
Meaning you, you certainly can consider what the trial judge said, but you don't have to give deference to it. It's your
decision. I mean, are we asking, are we deciding how we would sentence as an original matter?
No. This all, I think, can be wrapped up, I hope, rather clearly, maybe not. In Outen, Judge Hamburg, writing for the Third Circuit, when he was talking about one juror changing a vote, he was referring to the language from Wiggins. And that comes from a Wiggins state, where it's not a judge sentencing, where if one juror votes for life, that can hang the jury and result in a sentence of life. So that's where this whole one juror changing comes from. I think much more important than that, I actually agree with this a little bit.
I'm sorry, Outen arose under a different statutory scheme.
But I'm just explaining where this concept came from, of even one juror changing the vote.
Okay.
But at page 422 of the Outen decision in the Third Circuit, what Judge Amber also says, quoting Wiggins, is, had the jury been able to place Outen, in this case Swan's, excruciating life history on the mitigating side of the scale, there is a reasonable possibility of one juror having changed. You could substitute one juror having changed with reasonable probability of a different outcome. So the real analytical analysis this court has to do is look at the mitigating evidence, look at the excruciating life history we presented in state post-conviction. And if that excruciating tortured life history causes you to believe that there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome, that's your answer. I think the rest of the sort of one juror changing and all this, it's not easily transferable to this, to Delaware statute. And I admit that Judge Ambrose didn't exactly explain his reasoning there. He simply said this was a close case, this man had a terrible life history, and when you have a terrible life history and a close case, there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
Let me ask you, hypothetically, assuming you have a case where it's a close case on the question of prejudice, who has the burden of demonstrating prejudice?
Well, the burden is on us by the reasonable likelihood standard. It's our burden.
Okay, so if it's in equal poise, the burden's not carried, prejudice is not shown, the
frankly, Justice Ridgely, this is not equal poise. This is a case where horrendous things happened to my client that the jury never heard about because his lawyers didn't do their job properly.
I understand your point, but if it were, and
if it were, tie goes to the runner. I don't have an answer for you, Justice Berger. I just want to.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Wiseman, you're out of time.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Court's in recess.